This week's podcast will be postponed so we may bring you 48 minutes of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's closing argument in his impeachment trial.
It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And you know, Ken, I hear music. I hear music walking around in Washington these days. Everywhere I go, I hear violins. I hear the swelling strains of a string section.
Well, look,
it's like an overture everywhere I go.
Well, NPR is in a bad neighborhood. There's violins everywhere.
Yes, I understand, but there is a new spirit here in Washington because we have a new president, and he is romancing and courting the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans. And boy, they've been really responsive, haven't they, Ken?
Well, look, if you're a House Republican, nobody should pay attention to you because you're in the minority in the House. And, of course, even if the Democrats have a majority of one vote, nobody cares what the House Republicans
have to do. All right, House rules are abusive. They're brutal. They don't give them any kind of chance to play, and they don't play nicely with
any minority party, whether it's the Democrats or Republicans.
The Republicans did the same thing for 12 years when they were in the majority.
And the Democrats, 40 years.
And I understand all of that. Nonetheless, this new president made a special trip up to Capitol Hill, had a Republicans-only meeting where no Democrats were involved. He pled for some votes on his stimulus bill. He did the same thing over on the Senate side. We've only had a vote so far in the House. And how did that go, Ken? How many Republicans did he get?
Well, let's see. Was it one?
Zero. In fact, actually, the best he did was with one Republican who did not vote. She could have come, and then it would have been 178 to nothing.
Right, but it was 177 Republicans voting no, but there were also 11 Democrats who voted no.
Yes, and interestingly enough, of those Democrats, 8 of them came from the Deep South, and the other 3 came from districts I think you could safely describe as pretty Republican districts. Colin Peterson from Minnesota, Walt Minnick from Idaho.
You're saying that's a Republican district?
Yes.
But, you know, it's interesting. A lot of them were freshmen. You had Bobby Bright of Alabama. You had Parker Griffith of Alabama. You had Walt Minnick of Idaho. You had Heath Shuler, a sophomore. A lot of these new members, Brad Ellsworth of Indiana, conservative Democrats in Republican districts voting no, but only 11 of them. So for all
that's
the wooing,
actually fairly surprising. When you think back to the classic era of Democratic majorities in the 60s and 70s, those and 80s, those majorities were entirely dependent on 40, 50, 60 votes from the southern states. And now, while there is a larger number than just 11 from the southern states, many of them are either Hispanic or African American, and they vote with the National Democratic leadership, even though they're from the South. So what we have is fewer white Democrats from the South, but we still have enough that they could make a presence on this vote and make it look a little bit more as though it were not a straight line party.
But compare it to the Bill Clinton economic bill in 1993.
I've been doing that.
When actually no Republican again voted for it, but many Democrats split with him. And of course, Marjorie Margolis Mezvinsky.
Goodbye, Marjorie.
Exactly. They waved goodbye to her because she was the deciding vote against it. So anyway,
it had a tax increase in it. Let me just
point out. The biggest in history.
Let's just point out that bill in 1993 that it was tough to get Democrats to vote for, and in fact, they needed Al Gore to break the tie in the Senate.
Right.
That vote had tax increases in it. This is tax cuts, government spending. It's giveaway.
A lot of it were concessions.
Pop the cork. It's a big party.
A lot of it were concessions to Republicans to get some Republicans on board. They got none.
Yeah.
But what I suspect Barack Obama was doing was not to see if he can get Republican votes. One, I think he wanted to point out that his predecessor, George W. Bush, did not go out of his way to try to get Democrats involved in the process. So he made the magnanimous decision to say, I am open to negotiating with Republicans, talking to Republicans. I'm not going to compromise my principles. I'm not going to gut the bill to get their votes, but I'm going to talk to them. And the other thing I think is that what he was doing was trying to get Republican support for future votes, not so much this one, because I think he had the votes he needed in his pocket for the $816 billion stimulus bill, but not for upcoming votes is what he was trying to get.
All right. So there's a gesture involved here, and his real audience was not those House Republicans or even the Senate Republicans that he's still wooing. It was the whole country. on beyond Washington. He was showing in this gesture of bipartisanship that he wants to reach out to them. At the same time, of course, the bill they had to vote on was a bill that they really hadn't had much to do with, if anything at all. And so they didn't really have any true reason to vote for it except wanting to support this new president, which, of course, they don't. The districts that they represent didn't vote for him.
Well, except for the fact that a lot of Republicans, I suspect a lot of Republicans who were reelected in 2008 do come from districts that went for Obama in states like Florida, in Ohio, in North Carolina, in Virginia, and yet they still voted against it anyway.
Do you have a number? How many of them come from districts that voted for Obama?
That's so unfair.
It is unfair, but on the other hand, it raises a real issue.
Oh, it's a good question, but I don't know the answer.
Here's the issue that it raises. If you're down to 178 Republican seats in the House, mm-hmm. 178 districts, how many more of those can the Republicans lose? How many more of those could the Democrats possibly win in? These are hard rock, bedrock Republican districts. They're going to stick. Those people that they're representing are not going to be won over to Barack Obama over the next 4 years, no matter what happens.
But there were several, I don't have a number in front of me, there were several Republicans who were reelected in 2008 by the narrowest of margins in Republican districts because the voters were dissatisfied with 8 years of Republican rule. So I suspect that even though these Republicans were reelected in 2008, some of them by the skin of their teeth and some of them are worrying about 2010. And if they voted against what's supposed to save the country, it could be retribution at the polls.
Okay, it's possible. But let me just say, I don't think those guys could possibly be in greater trouble in 2010 than they were in 2008 unless we bring back George W. Bush to be president.
I agree with that.
Not likely to happen. All right. A lot of other opportunities for Republicans to vote one way or another on things coming out of President Obama's shop. What about Tim Geithner,
well,
the Secretary of Treasury?
I was more interested in the Democrats who voted against Geithner. First of all, the vote was 60-34. That's a lot of votes against a new member of the cabinet because, you know, Obama can do nothing wrong. But I suspect that not everybody felt that Geithner was the right guy for the job. There was a lot of resentment. I got an email from over one person who suggested that Geithner might have been a mistake given the fact that had anybody else forgotten to pay taxes or mistakenly failed to pay taxes, they certainly wouldn't be in charge of the Treasury Department. But having said that, three Democrats voted against Geithner. Tom Harkin of Iowa, who often doesn't break with his party.
But is a populist and does like to look for his shots to be different.
Russ Feingold, who sometimes does break with his party. But again,
he did on John Ashcroft.
And yes,
in 2001, he was one of the very few Democrats
to vote for him, John Ashcroft. And Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who's not certainly not a conservative.
Straight down the line, you could say it was a tax vote, but I'm not so sure it was a tax vote.
And Bernie Sanders.
I think it was down the line a vote, as with Bernie Sanders, against TARP, against everything Tim Geithner was involved in last September when the federal government decided to bail out the financial industry.
So Tim Geithner may not be the change we've been waiting for.
Well, he's not the change from what we saw in September and October.
Right.
He is, if you will, the continuity back to the attempts to right the ship of the overall economy through the financial industry that were run by Henry Paulson. He's really continuity back to, if you will, the Bush solution.
But who wants continuity back to that? And my point is,
clearly the administration that just took office wants some continuity or they wouldn't have chosen Tim Geithner. This is a guy who goes back to not only the Bush administration, but all the way back to the Clinton administration when he was a deputy in the Treasury Department.
My argument, though, is was it worth the emails and the anger and the outrage from many people who felt this was a flawed pick?
It was a flawed pick from the beginning on two points. One, because he was too associated with the previous administration, and two, because he has been in the power structure too long for a man as young as he is. He has been steeped in a culture which can be held responsible for where the economy is now.
But I think
layer on top of that the tax issue.
Which Mr. and Mrs. American really hits home with, don't you think?
It does, except that clearly from the beginning it didn't really upset the Senate. It didn't really upset very many Republican senators. They just saw it as an opportunity to make this guy the one they were going to vote against. Previously, they thought the one they were going to vote against was going to be Eric Holder, which is a little bit embarrassing because he is African American. But once they decided, no, we're going to make Tim Geithner the whipping boy because of his tax issue, then they could give Eric Holder more of a pass. Eric Holder comes out of the Judiciary Committee with a 17-2 vote.
Before you leave Geithner.
He's going to do better on the floor of the Senate than Tim Geithner. That's an amazing
fact. Before you leave Geithner, so are you saying that Republicans who voted against Geithner did it for political purposes, but the three Democrats and one independent who voted against it was more principled?
No, absolutely not. I think they all voted against him for exactly the same reason, and it didn't have that much to do with principle. It had to do with the fact that he was politically a good target desire to vote against
See, that's back to the politics. You don't think people were hearing from people back home, lawmakers were hearing from people back home saying this is not the way it should work?
I don't think it was the tax issue.
No?
I really don't. I think that was an excuse.
Okay. Ron, how about that trip to Canada?
President Obama has announced that his very first trip out of the country is going to be to our neighbor to the north.
Complete opposite of George W. Bush.
Who went to?
Mexico.
Absolutely.
See?
Ha.
180-degree switch.
Couldn't be more different, could it?
We got the change that we deserve.
Absolutely.
Or something.
Okay.
Speaking of change,
what about the
new governor of Illinois?
Yes, we do. His name is Pat Quinn, and you know that perfectly well, Ken, because you've already written about it on your blog, Political Junkie.
So Pat Quinn is the new governor of Illinois, complete different person because, one, unlike Rod Blagojevich, Pat Quinn was born on Earth.
Yes, and also he does not have that funny little brush that has that funny little attachment that makes that funny little thing happen out in the front of the hair. Are these the important issues in Illinois?
It is for
me. Yes, I think it is.
For this podcast.
That's it for this week.
No. Well, maybe it is. Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Okay, Ken, you heard the entire 48-minute closing argument from Rod Blagojevich right here on this podcast. Tell me, what do you say, yay or nay?
Well, of course.
Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Well, obviously, the Senate.
Does he stay or does he go?
The clash?
But just drummer.
Yeah. But I suspect that, I mean, even though the Senate has already made its case and has removed Rod Blagojevich, only the 8th governor in history to be impeached and removed from office.
In all the country.
That's right.
In all 50 states.
In history. The last one, of course, was?
And not Ev Meacham.
It was Ev Meacham.
It was Ev Meacham in Arizona. I thought Fife Symington came after Ev
Meacham. He wasn't impeached.
He was removed, but he was not impeached.
So, a 48-minute rambling speech that obviously didn't change any minds.
He didn't have a speech prepared.
No, he didn't. It was very interesting. He did not read from notes. He just
spoke from the heart because he couldn't really speak from any organ in his head.
Right.
Look, there is a sadness here, really, and we don't want to make too many jokes about it because this is the 5th largest state in the union and they deserve to have a governor, and this man has obviously covered himself in obloquy. And obloquy.
Right. Is that the song by the Beatles? Life goes on.
All right. So I'm taking it your vote would be no, that he should, in fact, be convicted of the impeachment charges and removed from office.
No, my vote is that he did not change any minds. I mean, there was a very impassioned prosecutorial response after.
A rebuttal.
The governor still did not talk about anything about the selling of the Senate seat.
He said the tapes spoke for themselves.
Right, exactly.
I thought that was an eloquent way of dealing with the damning evidence against him, the condemnatory evidence as well.
But there was a sadness.
Kind of the nature of tape, actually.
There was a sadness, though, of listening to him trying to save his skin. And I don't know if he knew going in that he would not change any minds, but we all seem to.
Well, I was wondering if there was a possibility, you know, not Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but just that he would come out and at least make some kind of rational plea for the argument that he hasn't formally been charged, that he hasn't been formally convicted, which is true.
Both could
have argued the technicalities, or he could have argued that it's just not fair to remove him from office because he is such an obnoxious character, if that's all he's really been proven guilty of thus far.
But thank God for the electoral system, because, as you know, Pat Quinn was his heir apparent.
That's it for this week's political podcast, I hope.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.